Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
I am happy to welcome Catherine Stewart, author of The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism, which just came out earlier this month in, well, it was March of 2020. So thank you for being on Mindshift Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Yes, and as I was saying before we hit record, I've been doing a tremendous amount of reading, research, writing, talking to other people about dominion theology, Christian Reconstructionism, Christian nationalism. So I'm glad that your book has come out because I've just started going through it myself. I've got about three or four chapters into it and I made a bunch of notes. So I don't know if we can get through all the notes, but I'm hoping that you'll be able to help people get a grasp of this movement.
Sure.
So how did it begin? Let's go back maybe to the beginning because you talk a little bit about this in the introduction to your book. How did your investigation into this whole area of Christian nationalism begin?
So this is the backstory. I got into the topic first in 2009, when a Good News Club came to our kids' public elementary school in Santa Barbara, California. Mm-hmm. Good News Clubs are designed to convert very little children in their earliest years of learning into a deeply fundamentalist form of evangelical Christianity. And I was astonished, and they're doing this in public schools. And I was really astonished to learn that there were, you know, in thousands of these clubs operating in public schools or state schools nationwide, targeting elementary age kids with a message that they would go to hell without Jesus. And let's remember, public schools in America or state schools serve diverse communities, children of all faiths. And in our own community, I saw how these clubs were confusing very little kids into thinking that their school supported and endorsed a very particular form of the Christian religion. And the adults leading the clubs used their position inside the school to get kids who were attending these clubs to proselytize and recruit and often bully their non-Christian classmates. So I thought sometimes one parent told me, she said her kid came home and said, "Mommy, we're going to go to hell because we don't go to the right kind of church." So I thought these kinds of clubs were wildly inappropriate in a diverse public school setting. But at first I also thought they were really a relic of the American past. And it turns out I was wrong about that. So the more I learned about these clubs and the movement that they represented, the more concerned I became, and I was really stunned to learn about the movement's legal sophistication, its determination, its coherence, and high level of strategic thinking. I published a book about the religious rights attack on public education in 2012. And then over the years, I kept on writing and digging deeper. And I learned that these Good News Clubs were just one part of a larger attack on public education. And the attack on public ed was just one part of a larger attack on America's a modern constitutional democracy. I feel like we're at an all hands on deck moment. And so I wrote this book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. I wrote it because I felt like I had to do my piece.
So why should people care? I mean, as you say, okay, it's a relic of our past in America. Even though I don't live there anymore, I can certainly see the trends. I used to be an evangelical. I used to be a Christian. I was a pastor. I did all of that. And I would have said back then, what are you so upset about, Catherine? I mean, in fact, it's good. It's good news of the gospel. But we find out from programs like The Family on Netflix, that's what got me started into this whole sort of dominion theology and Christian Reconstructionism and Christian nationalism. When I saw the, not just American reach, but the global reach, should people be concerned about even the global reach of these organizations?
Well, absolutely. This is not just an American movement. This is a global movement. Under Trump, it's a piece of a global movement. Mm-hmm. The United States has become a kind of flashing beacon of hope for a new global religious right-wing populist movement. It calls itself a global conservative movement. If you read to chapter 12, you're going to learn all about it because I went to one of their large international gatherings. And I write about the larger movement, you know, they claim they're trying to defend what they call the natural family and just defend what they see as traditional marriage and things like that. But really, it's about taking down modern democracy and replacing it with authoritarian faith-based ethnostates. Mm. So the Christian nationalist movement within the United States, which is really my subject of this book, is just one piece of this increasingly interconnected globe-spanning movement. And it has nuances specific to different countries, quite, you know, multifarious circumstances and distinctions. But the striking thing about it is its consistency in tone and substance around the world. Mm. And it defines itself against a single common worldwide enemy, which they call global liberalism. It's a hostility to democracy. It's a hostility to the idea of representative government. And it's also, in many instances, a real alliance with plutocratic fortunes, mm. you know, sort of allowing the people with the most money to sort of have the most power. So Americans have long told ourselves a story about our exceptionalism, and we often point to our religiosity as a part of that story. But in fact, our religious nationalism is the least exceptional thing about America. I mean, let's just think about how it works around the world. Look at Erdogan in Turkey or mm-hmm. in Russia or Orban in Hungary. When these leaders ally them, bind themselves tightly to religious conservatives in their countries in order to consolidate a more authoritarian form of power, we rightly recognize that as a form of religious nationalism. And that's what we're seeing in America today with Trump's alliances with their own religious hyper-conservatives.
Well, and those are the very people that he admires and he aspires to be, like Putin and other despots and dictators, doesn't he? And as you say, that playbook, you see it in Brazil with Bolsonaro. He's allied himself with some real similar kind of evangelical people down there. And you see that same playbook repeating itself now. They're emboldened by what Trump has been able to do, I think, in the United States on some level, surely.
That's true. I mean, it's important to remember that it's a radical ideology. It's anti-democratic. In America, it has very little respect for the Constitution as it was written, representative democracy, or even the two-party system itself. But worldwide, it aims for a more authoritarian form of power and a system in which people with the supposedly correct religious views have a sort of like a first-class citizenship, have the power certainly to discriminate against others of whom they disapprove, and often to receive public funding or government funding for the purpose.
It's true, and there's a worldwide movement, certainly an anti-immigrant movement in Europe. You can see it all over the place, and here in the UK, there's a big reaction against a lot of, let's say, the Muslim population that's moving out, refugees from places like Syria and other parts, coming through Turkey and then coming across into Europe. There's all sorts of movements in Germany and in Norway, Sweden, the UK, France, where it's a very right wing, and that's allied too with that religious, because they can point to this Muslim refugee population and say, well, they're the enemy. Clearly, they're Muslims, they're terrorists and all the rest of it. Scapegoating, it seems to work. It worked for Hitler anyway, didn't it?
Yeah, and it's really interesting in America because America is a nation of immigrants, explicitly so. So when you have people who sort of work with the movement, you know, I think that a lot of people point to white nationalism. It's not completely aligned with the movement at all. But if you look at a Venn diagram, there's a bit of overlap when they sort of talk about, you know, how we will not be replaced. I think, where did your parents come from? where did your parents come from?
Exactly. Well, looking at the roots of it, what about the historical roots of it? Because I think a lot of people might point to the, let's say, go back to 2016, you know, this huge groundswell of evangelical support for Trump. And it's like, whoa, this is a whole new thing. But it goes back further and further, doesn't it? You can go back to people like Jerry Falwell Sr., the Moral Majority. They looked at anti-abortion and homosexuality. They were the two big planks in their platform, weren't they? But you're saying, I think in your book, it might even go further back than that, back into the slavery and all of that. Can you put the pieces together?
Oh, there are so many pieces. I'll take a stab at it.
There's a lot to it.
You know, the movement long preceded Trump and will unfortunately long outlast him. So, you know, any student of power knows that the first step in controlling the present is controlling the past and the story of the past. And one thing that the movement has been incredibly successful at is controlling the story of their own past. They've kind of sold us this idea that the movement was a grassroots reaction to abortion and really started up in 1973 with the passage of Roe versus Wade, which is a Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion. But this is not true. One of the key issues that animated the movement in its earlier days was the fear that racially segregated schools, they were called Christian academies, but they were racially segregated, might be deprived of their lucrative tax exemption. So Jerry Falwell, Sr., and many of his fellow Southern white conservative pastors were closely involved with these segregated Christian schools and universities. Bob Jones Sr. is another one. He went so far as to call segregation, quote, God's established order. I mean,
it was on the books at Bob Jones University. You couldn't have interracial dating or marriage until fairly recently, actually.
I know, shockingly recently. He actually referred, and the idea is there's sort of associated desegregationists or those who supported racial equality with communism, and he called them satanic propagandists who are leading colored Christians astray. He actually delivered a really unbelievable sermon about this, which is worth looking up if you can find it. It's footnoted in my book, and really find it and read it. It's astonishing. A lot of these pastors had to kind of defend the biblical basis of segregation. And as far as they were concerned, they had the right not just to separate people on the basis of color, but also to receive federal money for the purpose. So they coalesced around the fear that the Supreme Court was going to end tax exemptions for segregated Christian schools. But they knew, they were trying to create a broad-based movement. They were trying to unite disparate elements of it. And even then, they knew that overt racism was really not going to play well with the general public. They knew that stop the tax on segregation wasn't going to be an effective rallying cry to inspire a kind of broad-based, hyper-conservative counter-revolution, which is what they wanted. So there's a fascinating episode that's also been written about by Randall Balmer and some other really wonderful historians. They all got together and basically went down a laundry list of issues that they thought might unite their new movement. So I'm talking 79 or so, about 6 years after Roe v. Wade was passed. Number one was that they viewed as the threat to the tax privileges of these racist academies. Women's rights movement was another. They were really upset that women were seeking equality. But the Equal Rights Amendment was kind of going down in flames at the time. So there were several other issues on this list. Then they came down to abortion and said, wow, that could work. I mean, part of the history that's been erased by movement leadership is that, abortion was not the single most important issue when it came to their vote. They wanted to unite conservative Catholics and conservative evangelicals. And at the time, abortion was really viewed as a kind of Catholic issue, but it didn't reliably divide Republicans from Democrats. It was just more of an issue that was more of concern to Catholic voters. So, I mean, let's look at the overtime piece of this. And let's remember at the time of 1973, when Roe v. Wade was passed, most Protestants, Republicans supported some form of abortion law liberalization. Mm-hmm. And so let's just take a look at that and see how that changed. So when Roe v. Wade was passed, an editorial in the Wire Service run by the Southern Baptist Convention hailed the decision. Just think about that. The Southern Baptist Convention hailed the passage of Roe v. Wade. They saw it as a sensible middle ground. Ronald Reagan passed, he was like a conservative hero. He passed the most liberal abortion law in the country in 1967. Mm-hmm. And activists like Peggy Goldwater, who was the wife of Barry Goldwater, who's another big conservative hero, she was a co-founder of Planned Parenthood in Arizona. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about that. So most conservative Republican Protestants supported abortion law liberalization at the time. But then these activists of that group that you were mentioning earlier, Jerry Falwell, Paul Weyrich, Phyllis Schlafly was connected to the group. They saw the potential for this issue to unite this new movement. So over time, they purged pro-choice voices from the Republican Party. So now we have a kind of, it's almost like a pro-life religion, that we see dominating the Republican Party, and it's a modern creation, and it was created for these political purposes. So that's one, I think, important piece of the history that is often overlooked.
Well, as you point out in the book, you say that one of the common themes that you hear from Christian nationalists is this American story, like you say, controlling the narrative that America was founded as a Christian nation. We've all heard this before, you know. The Puritans came over for religious freedom, and they saw themselves as a covenant nation with God, and we're still in that covenant theology sort of thing. And you see that all through Christian nationalism. I see it in Dominion theology, Christian Reconstructionism. People like David Barton of Wall Builders, you know, he's popularized this narrative all over the place, and you see it from low to high. I think a lot of evangelicals may not understand the links with these other movements, but they'll spout that narrative. So it's working. They've controlled the narrative.
That's true. And I'm glad you mentioned David Barton. I mean, he actually cites this mid-century theologian who you're aware of, no doubt, Roussas, John Rush Dooney.
Oh, yeah. the father of Christian Reconstructionism.
Father of Christian Reconstruction. And much of the current crop of Christian nationalists are descended from, among others, Rush Dooney. Mm-hmm. He's a sort of a thinker whose ideas continue to speak.
Yeah,
long
he's kind of the godfather of it.
Exactly. So the main thing to know about Rush Dooney is he was intensely hostile to the principle of equality. Mm-hmm. And he endorsed an austere biblical literalism and rigid hierarchies, which he asserted were ordained by God. And he saw it as, you know, he thought America was founded as a Christian nation. He saw it as his job to rescue America from its commitment to godless secularism, which is something these religious nationalists are saying all the time. So his theology included an opposition to government assistance to the poor, which he cast as slavery to the state. He called social welfare programs slavery to the state. And some Christian nationalist thinkers today, including Barton, say very similar things. So he shares so much with the Christian nationalists of today, the idea that the U.S. is a Christian nation chosen by God, that it should be an Orthodox Christian republic in which women are subservient to men, education is in the hands of conservative Christians. He abhorred public schools. Mm-hmm. As you probably know, he wrote this book called The Messianic Character of American Education. It's just a kind of unbelievable read. And, you know, that no one should pay taxes to support the poor or black people. And this, at some point, America deviated horribly from its mission and fell under the control of atheist and liberal elites. I mean, this is the life of Rush Dooney's thought. Mm-hmm. And some of these ideas are repeated and continued by many of the Christian nationalist thinkers today.
I think you're absolutely right, because what you have to do, this is what I've found in my research, is that you see key words, you hear talking points, and that's where you can make connections oftentimes from group to group, person to person, organization, church to church. Because one thing that struck me about reading the first few chapters of your book, you make the point that you would rather refer to this entire thing as Christian nationalism, whereas maybe I've been too focused on smaller movements within that, like Dominion theology, Christian Reconstructionism, Seven Mountains, Dominion theology. Why do you see it as a bigger umbrella term? Does it kind of encompass all of these movements generally?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about we need to know about this movement, which I often call Christian nationalism or religious nationalism, is that it's not a religion. Hmm. It's not. It's not Christianity. It's not evangelicalism. It includes many evangelicals, but excludes many evangelicals too. And it includes many varieties, representatives of a kind of both Protestant and non-Protestant religion. So it's not a religion. It's a political ideology. Its representatives insist that the foundation of legitimate government is bound up with a reactionary understanding of a particular religion. So it basically says the U.S. is founded on the Bible and can succeed only if it stays true to this foundation. And, you know, it's also a device for mobilizing and often manipulating large segments of the population and for concentrating power in like the hands of a new elite. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to say something else about it. Religious nationalism makes use of religion, but it's not trying to achieve religious or cultural or social aims. It's really trying to achieve political power, and it's an anti-democratic movement. because it says, as I said earlier, that the foundation of government is a strict interpretation of a particular religion. And I like to use the term religious nationalism because it makes clear its similarities with other forms of religious nationalism around the globe.
Well, we've seen it historically, haven't we? Anytime you see the rise of nationalism in general, we saw it in the early 20th century in Italy with Mussolini, obviously Hitler. They both appealed to the nationalism of the Italian people and the German people to get their agenda across, and it worked. It absolutely worked. So people should be pricking up their ears and going, wait a minute, this is not a good thing to be happening. Well, what about some of the key leaders? Because you mentioned Rush Dooney, we talked about David Barton. Who are some of the key leaders? If someone said, okay, I think I need to go out and get your book, and I need to find out who are the key players in this movement. What are they doing? What are they up to?
Oh my gosh. I mean, my book is filled with them. Mm. There's Trump himself, of course. And just offhand, I'll say Betsy DeVos, Mike Pence. When we're talking about the leaders of the movement, are you talking about the leaders within, are you talking about who's influenced by the leaders? Are you talking about people in the Trump admin?
It's both and, isn't it? Because you've got, as you say, some very high profile people. Ralph Drollinger, for example, he's leading Bible studies in the White House every week, and Pence is dropping in, and you know, there's some big players out there right now. And as you say, they've obviously been influenced by people like Rush Dooney, C. Peter Wagner, big players from the past.
Great. Yes, I misunderstood the question. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of members of the Trump administration who are influenced by the movement, but they are perhaps not directing the movement. Mm. I mean, I name a number of leading figures in my book, but more important in a way than the individual leaders are the organizations. The movement isn't exactly leaderless, but it is sort of centralist. I mean, political movements are pretty complicated, and this one is even more complicated than most and consists of a kind of a dense ecosystem of for-profit and non-profit groups, like right-wing policy groups, legal advocacy organizations, data initiatives, and media and networking groups. So its leadership cadre has a number of often personally interconnected activists and politicians, and it derives a lot of its power direction from an informal club of funders, a number of them belonging to these hyper-wealthy families. It took me some time to kind of navigate the sea of acronyms and generations and kinship and policy networks. And I really try and lay out as much of this in my book as I could. But the important thing to understand about the collective effort is not its really variety, but the profound source of its unity, which is a common political vision. And, you know, as far as the organizations go, there are a number of them. I think it's important to note that there are dozens of national organizations that are working to unite and organize the many thousands of organizations advancing the cause at the lower level. So offhand, I'd say some of the more important organizations are like the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is a legal juggernaut of the Christian right, the Family Research Council, which is one of the leading policy groups, David Barton's Wall Builders. It plays a sort of outsized role in sort of promoting the myths that the movement relies upon. There's a network of like think tanks funded by like the DeVos family and so many others. Focus on the Family, which is a kind of another Christian right policy group. The Fellowship Foundation, which you mentioned earlier, which puts on the National Prayer Breakfast. I mean, there are so many others, Council for National Policy. The important thing to understand is that they're often interconnected, and certain names do appear in multiple initiatives.
Just taking a very short break in my conversation with Catherine Stewart. We're going to be getting back into it in a minute. I just wanted to give you a quick update as to what's coming up here on Mindshift Podcast. I'm really looking forward to having a conversation with two of my favorite ex-evangelical pastor friends. I am going to be speaking with David Hayward and Tim Sledge. Of course, Tim is the author of a couple of books. The first one is Goodbye Jesus, An Evangelical Preacher's Journey Beyond Faith. And his more recent work is one entitled Four Disturbing Questions with One Simple Answer, Breaking the Spell of Christian Belief. And I'm also going to be having on that same call David Hayward, who is also known as the Naked Pastor. You will have seen his cartoons poking fun, lambasting in a very poignant way what's going on in the church. He is also offering right now, actually, a free course online. He is reading his book called The Liberation of Sophia. He is reading 59 Meditations of Sophia with personal comments, and this can be found on DavidHaywardCourses.com, and right now you can enroll on it for free. So that's coming up. We are going to be talking about the Christian responses to the coronavirus, among other things. What do we make of it? All three of us as ex-pastors, ex-theologians, what do we make of all the various wacky and nutty and strange responses that we're seeing, not just in America, but indeed the world? And so we're going to unpack some of that and try to get behind what's going on. Also, I've been in talks with Conway and Siegelman, of course, who wrote the books Holy Terror and Snapping. We are scheduling a podcast interview coming up very soon. And also, I'm going to be talking to David from The Graceful Atheist. In fact, I just did a recording with him the other day, and it is going to come out on his show, I believe, on the 30th of April. And then I'm going to return the favor and have him on the show. We had an absolutely fantastic chat just the other night as I'm doing this recording. So I'm looking forward to hearing that recording again. So listen for these episodes coming up. We've got Tim Sledge and David Hayward, Conway and Siegelman, and David from The Graceful Atheist. So there is some just absolutely fantastic content headed your way coming up in the next few weeks. I was going to say, too, if you want to get a hold of me on social media, the best way to do that is to follow me on Twitter at MindShift2018. And finally, if you want to support this show on Patreon, that would be great. I would really appreciate it. One of the benefits that you get, of course, besides the early releases of the show, which drop on Wednesdays on Patreon, so you don't have to wait till the Fridays when they come out, you get access to our closed Mindshift Podcast Facebook group. And one of the things that we do there every month, we have a Mindshift Podcast Zoom call. And one of the things that I really enjoy doing is having people that I've had on the show drop in as guests of the call. In fact, we had Chris Shelton, ex-Scientologist. He was on the call last month. If you want to see that call, by the way, I did post it on my Mindshift Podcast Facebook page if you want to look at what we talk about this month, actually on the 26th of April. So actually just a couple of days after this episode drops, we're going to have Stephanie McCown. She's going to be our guest on the call. She was just on the show just a few weeks ago. She's the author of the book Raised Evangelical. That's R-A-Z-E-D. And we had an absolutely fantastic conversation. So I'm looking forward to getting Stephanie on the call in our group and having just an absolutely wonderful conversation about her journey and where everybody else is at. So that's some of the benefits that you get for being a supporter of the show on Patreon. And as always, the links to my Patreon page are in the show notes. Anyway, that's enough of the business. Let's get back into my conversation with Catherine Stewart. Well, and as you say, it's very hard to pin some of these organizations down. One of the things that jumped out at me when I watched that series, The Family, was that Doug Coe, the then president, he kept saying, we are intentionally going underground. We are intentionally striving to be invisible to the public. The only public thing, as you say, that they put on is the prayer breakfast once a year. We don't know who they're meeting with. We don't know what they're talking about. It really is an anti-democratic institution. They're not sharing with the public what they're actually up to. And that documentary shone a light on some of their activities. So it's really hard to trace some of this stuff because they're intentionally trying to hide it, aren't they?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's some stuff that's not visible, but a lot of what they're doing is actually hiding in plain sight. Mm-hmm. It's not that they're hiding what they're doing. It's that we're not listening.
All right. We're not aware of what's going on.
Yeah, I think people aren't really paying attention. People often are focusing their attention on the wrong things. Mm. When leaders of the policy group say that they want to basically, you know, take over, you know, certainly when the Dominionists say that they want to take over and achieve like a domination over what they call the seven mountains of culture, We should listen to them and take them at their word.
That's exactly what they're trying to do.
And they think very open about it.
Yeah. They think right now they've got a guy who, according to C. Peter Wagner, he wrote an article right before he died talking about his support for Trump as a candidate. And he said, look, Trump he's already conquered three mountains, the media, obviously business and finance. And now he's going to conquer the third, another mountain of government. So three out of seven, he's our guy, you know, he's, and that's the way C. Peter Wagner, who was hugely influential in the Seven Mountains variety, Dominion theology and all that, he was, that's how he saw Trump as a candidate, you know? So that kind of says a lot, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, I think that a lot of people shy away from talking about religion, certainly a lot of reporters or a lot of individuals. Like, it would be a nicer world, wouldn't it, if we could all just, you know, worship as we choose and allow one another to do so, and kind of leave this private sphere of conscience and worship out of politics. You know, this is the whole idea of the separation of church and state, and sort of allow one another to have these beliefs. But this is a movement that's actually a political movement that's really making use of religion. It's cloaking its political actions in religious rhetoric. And it's hard to talk about it without appearing to slight or insult religion itself. But there really is a difference.
Well, and as you said, the average garden variety evangelical, they're sitting in that church pew in, you know, any town USA. They're hearing this, though, from their pastor, who is being himself or herself encouraged to preach a certain message. Here's these voter guides. They've been handed out by the Family Research Council or other organizations, telling them who to vote for and who to vote against. So, yeah, it filters right down to the populist level. And this is one of the ways they do it, isn't it?
It's absolutely true. I mean, they're, you know, leaders of the movement understand very well that pastors drive votes. And so they made this huge effort to organize pastors into these networks and get them all on board and give them talking points to turn out their congregations to vote for the hyper-conservative candidates that the movement favors. And they know very well that if you can get people to vote on a single issue or on one or two issues, you can capture their vote. So when movement leaders are talking to the rank and file, or when they talk to pastors about talking to their congregations to get out the vote, it's all abortion all the time. Abortion is the beginning and the end. It's usually that first or maybe the second, but usually the first item on those voter guides that they distribute. So a lot of the rank and file are just people who are like, you know, I really want to save the babies. And you know, that's really sort of where it begins and ends. And in fact, I've been to these pastor gatherings where one leader was, a movement leader was telling all these pastors who were gathered together, when you're talking to your congregations about these issues, and he was talking about financial issues, he said, what's more important, talking about the minimum wage or about life? And when you put it that way, it's like a few extra bucks or life itself, you know, there's no question. But you know, when these movement leaders are speaking to one another in the forms that they share, and especially when they're talking to their political allies or their very ultra wealthy funders, they advocate this wide range of policy positions. And a lot of this is about money. This is so overlooked. It's really about how the Bible favors low taxes for the rich. I mean,
we're seeing that.
It's precisely the exact opposite of how many Christians would interpret the Bible. They're saying how Bible is against rights for the workforce, against environmental regulations, against environmentalism itself, and against regulation of business. It's really completely allied with the power of wealth. And again, this hits home the fact that this is a political movement, not just a so-called culture war. They're aiming to concentrate power in the hands of a new elite.
And you can see, as you point out, the, all those things you just listed, they've all been passed in one form or another by the Trump administration. They've rolled back environmental policies. They've given tax cuts to corporations and the wealthy and on down the line. And they're supporting, I mean, we've seen a recent spate, I guess it was last year, of eight or nine states that tried to pass some really draconian anti-abortion laws. And as I saw it at the time, it was sort of an opening salvo. They knew they were going to get shot down. And I know maybe this is, some of this goes along with Project Blitz. They were just trying to blitz the courts with all sorts of legislation, knowing that a lot of it would get shot down, but it would clog up this legal system such that they would eventually get their agenda through, one of which was, as you say, to overturn Roe versus Wade. And I know a lot of Christians are looking at the two recent Supreme Court appointees and saying, that's it. We are now, we've got a majority on the Supreme Court. We are going to overturn Roe versus Wade in our lifetime, and we're going to win.
It's true. I mean, you know, often ask the question, like, how could people who purport to care about values and a defense of the American family vote for someone who is so, I mean, I just don't know where to begin. And a lot of people think, the support for him is transactional. They think, well, he's going to appoint judges favorable to our interests. Or I think some of the wealthier people, or even some of the people who've just been bamboozled, think, well, he's going to endorse economic policies that are favorable to our pocketbooks. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think we can't overlook something else that is really important. The support for Trump is not entirely transactional. While it's true they get the deal they're looking for, you can't explain the tenacity of the movement and the kind of hyper-loyalty of their support on purely transactional terms. There's something about Trump's style of politics that speaks to the leaders of this group for sure, and that is a kind of tribal politics and authoritarian politics.
Well, absolutely. And I was going to reference, there was that recent Pew survey that was done back in February of 2020. I mean, look at the statistics. 63% of white evangelical Protestants believe that their side has been winning politically. 63%. And then the shocking one, 90% of white evangelical Christians say they want their president to stand up not only for religious beliefs in general, but for their religious beliefs in particular, including biblical teachings. 9 out of 10 evangelicals want the Bible to have an influence on the American legal system. So it's working. There's a huge majority of evangelicals, white evangelicals, that are winning as they see it.
It's really kind of astonishing, because there is also a movement of white evangelicals who oppose the politics of conquest and division mm-hmm. that this movement represents. I mean, I'm thinking about the Red Letter Christians and mm-hmm. Vote for Common Good and so many others, many of them question whether this kind of ideology is Christian in the first place. I'm not going to, you know, weigh in here on that account, but it's important to note that there is some diversity within every group. A lot of people promote the movement as a kind of, you know, they say it's just white evangelicals, but I want to note also, and I described this in my book, in recent years, the movement has made a significant effort to reach out to some pastors, conservative-leaning pastors of color, in particular Latino pastors of color. They know that, like, they can see the demographic future as clearly mm-hmm. as you or I can, and they know that if they don't win some number of Latino voters to their side, particularly in swing districts, they're going to be losing elections. So they've made, like, this really incredible effort to draw these pastors into these networks like Watchmen on the Wall or Church United, and those pastoral networks that get everybody, all the pastors, on the same page politically. But there's a real irony here in that they're driving these pastors to fight the culture wars that will drive support for a political party that engages in blatant voter suppression and gerrymandering, often race-based. So if you look at what's happening in various states where, you know, Democratic polling places are shut down, they're making it harder for people to vote, they're disenfranchising Democratic voters, making it all the while, you know, easier in a way for conservative Republicans to turn out the vote.
Mm-hmm. Well, and ironically, Trump just said the other day, because the Republicans have been trying to, they're against the vote by mail.
Right.
And obviously, right now during the coronavirus, people shouldn't be standing in huge lines and going into voting booths. They should be voting by mail just from a pure safety point of view and all that. But Trump said, well, if people voted by mail, no Republicans would get elected anymore. Yeah, so one of the few times where I actually agree with Trump.
I know. And true. It's interesting. He's not the first person to say it either. I mean, Paul Weyrich, you can find it on YouTube. You see him. It's again footnoted in my book, but he says, you know, I don't want everyone to vote. I'm going to paraphrase him a little bit here. He says something like, our influence elections goes up when the number of people who vote goes down. I mean, he said this. He was one of the leaders of the New Right, which is a kind of political movement that has played a key role in building what is today's religious right.
Absolutely. Well, one thing that struck me reading through your book was that you describe churches across America, they're viewed by the leaders of some of these organizations, they're like cells. They're like these little cells where if they can get these cells politically active, then they can get their agenda across, getting them to vote certain ways, getting them involved in political races and having them run for public office in their area. But it seems like there's a difference between kind of that foot soldier's view, you know, the person at the bottom who's just voting a certain way or getting involved in local politics versus, as you say, the person at the top. I was reading through Sarah Diamond's book, Roads to Dominion, And she talks about way back in the late 70s when they approached Jerry Falwell Sr. And they basically said, look, we want you to be the point man because you've got such a huge listening audience to your radio and your TV broadcast. We need to tap into that block. And there again, you see that dichotomy between the leadership who just wants to get that base to do their bidding. And it's worked. It seems like it's working.
You're absolutely right about that. I mean, you know, as you mentioned, the foot soldiers might believe they're fighting for things like a traditional marriage or a ban on abortion. They want to save the babies. But over time, these leaders and strategists have reframed these issues in order to capture and control the votes of that large subsection of the American public.
Okay, I got one last question for you then. What would you say to that garden variety evangelical? Okay, he or she, you know, average Christian, nice person, you know, they go to work, they pay their taxes, they treat their friends well, their neighbors well, they go to church on Sunday, they're a good citizen, blah, blah, blah. But what would you say to that person who is, okay, maybe even unwittingly participating in this Christian nationalist agenda? Maybe they don't even know that they're part of this thing. What would you say to that person? I mean, is that the vision that people want for America?
I mean, you know, it depends if they were a member of my family or
religion and politics.
I know. Well, you know, look, more important than communicating, I think, with the most committed Trump supporters, those, you know, people who are just never going to budge, and is really communicating with those on the fence. I mean, in a country where 40 to 50% of people don't bother to turn out to vote, you don't need a majority to win elections. You just need a really small, committed minority. And a system is politically fragmented, ours in particular, even these small groups, if they're united, can dominate. So we need to get people to understand the breadth of what they're voting for or the consequences of them sitting out the election and help people understand why unity is necessary when necessary. I mean, one thing the religious right has been so good at doing is getting people to vote on judges. I remember being at one of those events that I attend. I go to a lot of the right-wing conferences, and I heard one leader say, this election is about judges, judges, judges. And that message was sent there to persuade the people who might not like Trump's character per se, but to understand that there's a larger aim here. So I think sometimes people sit on elections because they think, oh, you know, both sides are bad, or this is the message they're certainly being told, you know, both sides are bad, there's no one to vote for. Oh, such and such a candidate isn't perfect, I don't like the detail of his health care plan, or maybe he said something, you know, unwise back in 1982. Well, you know what? We need to look a little bit beyond some of these, the minutiae, and look a little bit beyond personality and understand you're not just voting for a candidate. You're voting for the justices they are going to appoint. Trump has appointed not just two Supreme Court judges, 192 federal judges. That's over 22% of the federal judiciary. Just one president. Trump has done that. And if he gets another 4 years, are we looking at another 22%? So I think people need to understand that a lot of the movement is advanced through the courts. A lot of the rulings that they don't like, and they're not just putting in place this sort of right-wing social policy. It's really all about advancing a certain kind of economic policy, environmental policy. And I think, you know, I mean, let's look what the religious right does that's right. They have a very positive voting culture. They make you feel like no matter how young you are, no matter how old you are, no matter if you're disabled, your vote matters. We're going to help you get there. And they are able to turn out their people in disproportionate numbers. So if those of us who support those politics of conquest and division and support pluralism and equal rights for all and all that other good stuff can sort of get together and unify when necessary, we really have a chance to push back on that agenda.
Well, and as you point out in the book, Christians have long embraced that narrative that they've been persecuted. They are still being persecuted by somebody. I guess, well, a lot of it, they looked at the Obama presidency as 8 years of hell and Trump is the Cyrus figure who's leading them out of the captivity and that whole narrative. You know, they're finally, we've got a guy in the White House who's fighting on our side. But I can remember even as probably a young teen, listening to Dr. James Dobson, who you mentioned, Focus on the Family, on the radio. We grew up evangelical in the Seattle area, and he was encouraging people way back then in the mid-early 80s, to call their congressperson, call their senators, vote. You know, so it goes way back even that far. And I thought at the time, yeah, you know, we need to be involved. We need to be doing this. So I can see the appeal to that garden variety evangelical, that your vote matters. You're important. You can call your local politician and give them an earful. And yeah, let's do it.
Exactly. I mean, they really are, you know, training the rank and file to engage in politics in meaningful ways. And, you know, they're using the tools of democracy. These tools are readily available.
They're there.
To all of us. They're investing in data and media and messaging and teaching people how to vote and not making people feel foolish if they don't know how to register. They, you know, really reach out to people and this are very, you know, meet people where they are. And I think that that's really important on all ends of the political spectrum. Mm-hmm. Those tools are available to everyone. I mean, I think sometimes progressives think that showing up for March and, you know, carrying a kind of cool sign is a substitute for engaging in the political process in ways that are intended to turn out the vote. And it's not. It's not a substitute. If you want to march, that's fine. But like, if you would invest, you know, the same amount of effort or more in turning out the vote, then we can actually start to win elections and take our country back.
Well, and as you point out in the book, the progressive side is nowhere near that sort of grassroots level of involvement and passion. As you say, you know, just look at the Trump rallies, huge numbers of evangelicals, and they are all in for this guy. They don't care about his behavior. They don't care about any of that. That Pew survey recently showed that most of them don't really care about his personal behavior. What they care about is that they're winning and that he's their guy in the White House.
Right. He sort of plays a kind of tribal politics. And I do have to mention again, it's not all evangelicals.
Absolutely,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, and a lot of the folks at his rally are probably not evangelical, but he does play that kind of tribal politics. It's funny, one of the sources in my book, he said to me, he's biracial himself, and he sort of was in the movement for a while. He said, like, your belonging is really not even based, I mean, he noted the racism, you know, the way that that kind of hyper-conservative religion and racism can reinforce one another. And he also noted the ways in which some of the movement leaders paper over the racism that's sort of implicit in the movement. But he said, your sense of belonging is not even based race anymore. It's not even based in religion. Your sense of belonging comes by your political beliefs. I get mail all the time from these organizations like the Family Research Council. And there was I wish I had it in front of me, but most recent letter I got from Tony Perkins said something to the effect of, an attack on Trump is an attack on all of us. It's not an attack on him. It's an attack on you. Mm. So they're sort of, they're uniting people with a sort of tribal politics, this idea of us versus them, the insider versus the outsider, the pure and the impure. And
absolutely.
So those who sort of can hew to this kind of politics and believe rightly, you know, then you're kind of, you're in the in crowd. And you have a right and, in fact, a duty perhaps to, you know, dominate and inflict pain on other Americans who are not members of your so-called in crowd.
And that's what I would say to that garden variety evangelical. Yeah, they might be a wonderful person, but do you realize the extent to which this organizations like that are willing to go and what they're actually doing now that affects real people's lives? And where's this thing going to go? Where's this going to end up? I think a lot of people, yeah, they feel like this is their last gasp. You know, this is their last big shot to get all their stuff done. I mean, look at all those judges that they've appointed. We're talking in some cases, lifetime appointments. The next 20, 30 years, we're going to have these judges on the bench.
So have you had those conversations, and how do they go? Do you have those conversations with members of your family?
Well, that's the funny thing is that being over here, we don't really talk to many of our family members because they've disowned me for walking away from Christianity. I mean, I used to be a pastor. I was a Bible college teacher. I walked away from the whole faith and turned my back on all that. So most of my family are still very much involved in it. And yeah, a lot of them are Trump supporting evangelicals. We can't have a discussion. We've tried, and it just leads to an argument straight away. So that, you know, as you say, the divide is so stark. The partisanship is so unbelievable that you can't even just sit down and have a rational conversation about this topic. It just goes straight into an argument, which is unfortunate.
We can't discount the effect of the right-wing propaganda sphere that has
echo chamber
and, you know, casts everything in political terms. It's sort of, you know, one of the consequences, tragic casualties in a way of this kind of hyper-partisanship is coherent politics. Mm-hmm. Our country has never been so divided by religious animus and by, in some ways, sort of political animus. Or it has, but you know, it's been a long time, and that kind of division has been responsible for some of the most tragic events in our history.
It's true, and I heard something Chauncey DeVega said this on his podcast. He said that Trumpism will not go away when Trump leaves office, and I thought, you know, that's a really good quote. That's a good point. What the movement, what led to all this is not just going to stop if he gets voted out of office in November.
Right.
That's all, like you said, it's been there before and it's going to carry on. They'll just take a different tack if Joe Biden gets in or whoever. It's not going to be Bernie Sanders, obviously. But anyway, I know you want to go at about 45 minutes. Thank you so much for talking to me, Catherine, and for getting the word out there. Here's a question. How can people find your book and how can they get a hold of you?
Well, my book is The Power Worshippers Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. And it should be, it's Bloomsbury published it. It should be available everywhere books are sold. And you could look it up and find a place that's selling it. And you can follow me on Twitter at Kath S. Stewart. That's with two S's. Thank you so much for having me. Really been a pleasure to speak with you.
Yes, thank you so much. I will speak to you again.
I hope so. Look forward to it.